Joining me in the studio now is Senator Dick Anderson, state senator. He is passing through and doing some meetings in town, from town to town. He let everybody kind of get a better idea who he is, because he was, of course, our new senator that was elected last year. Now, Dick, one of the things that I want to know is, what is the general job responsibility that you have as a senator? I know I've talked with, you know, our representatives before, but never really had a chance to talk to the state senator. What are some of the things that your office is working on, responsible for?
You know, George, that's a good question, and thank you. My perspective, and that's what it would be of what I'm focusing on, and is really driven by, I think I said during my campaign, 12 years of local government, and being mayor of Lincoln City, and you know, all that stuff. And what I saw was how state government kind of what I would term infringes on local government with one policy fits all kind of policies. That irritated me. And so that's one of my drivers in the Senate, to answer your question. When I make floor speeches on bills that are on the floor, I usually start with, as a former mayor, here's what you're doing to local government, to try to set that tone. The other thing that I've been able to carve out is, I'm from the coast. The Oregon and is heavy urban areas, and Portland specific, with senators in this case, they need to be reminded that there's not just a rural Oregon, but there's a coastal Oregon, because rural and coastal are different. And I've been able to do that. They clearly know I'm a coastal representative. So I guess the way I would answer that is, when I look at issues coming forth from the state, I first evaluate on a coastal basis, then a constituent basis, and then kind of a party, you know, if you would, a caucus element. But my 4 years, I'm planning to, you know, represent loudly the citizens of the coast. I got good committee assignments. Three committees on Ways and Means, which is the budget committees. Full Ways and Means, which is unusual for new senator to be on. That means every budget item, every bill that has any fiscal, I see and vote on. Two subcommittees, natural resources and general government. So I see a lot of the agencies' budgets and stuff. In addition to that, two policies, housing and mental health, are the two policies.
Very important for...
Bingo. Yeah. And so those actually are ones I asked for. And surprise, I got them. One being a minority party and being a new senator, but I think those have the most impact for the coast. And if I can help solve the housing issue, help solve some of the, and get resources on the mental illness, behavioral health, behavioral science, you know, we'll be better off as a coastal area.
Well, when you talk about housing and mental health, sometimes, I mean, obviously there's different kind of housing issues. There's not enough housing.
Correct.
And then there's the population that can't get housing. And sometimes that intermingles with the mental health issue as well, when you put in homelessness into the factor and stuff like that. But when I hear you talking about, you know, the difference from the coast, like in Portland, obviously we want to be heard on the coast.
Correct.
But because the constituency of the populated areas are so heavy, how do you get heard? How do you talk them out of maybe some appropriations, you know, that we need for the coast? It must be difficult.
It is, because it's numbers, clearly. One of the things that we've got on the coast is called the Coastal Caucus. And caucuses are important in the legislature. 90 electeds, a lot of committees covering the state. The more you can align yourself, what I'm finding, the more I can align myself with different groups, then with commonality concerns, you benefit. Because then you're not just a lone voice or a lone vote. On the coast, we've got seven representatives, elected representatives, three senators and four House reps. And today, after the election in November, there are five Republicans and two Democrats. Prior to November of 2020, there were five Democrats and two Republicans. So it's switched.
Yeah.
But the power of those seven are so important because we all sit on different committees and we're in two different chambers. And so when we align, and we do with coastal issues, we have to agree, then we're powerful because we're talking to a lot of people in our separate committees and stuff.
And it's when more than one vote at that point.
Bingo. It's, you know, it's seven votes for sure. And it's usually, it'd be more than that because we've made arguments in our committees. So the caucus concept in this case, to answer your question, the other is just being a more knowledgeable not an expert, so to speak, but knowledge of issues, because I think the tendency in the state is to one policy fits all. Mm-hmm. And when I can speak to, for example, housing and housing specific on the coast, not just that we need it, but what's getting in the way, because our issues on the coast are different than Portland's or Eugene's. We don't have flat land or we don't have land at all available. So we've got to either tear down some dilapidated buildings to build, or we're on tough terrain.
Or we have marshy land, water,
land,
you know,
everything.
Wetlands.
And we, you know, we can't go west, forests on the east. So it's tough to find. And as a result, it drives up the cost of the units. And that's when you're on the dance for looking for state assistance, you know, you're being compared with other projects around the state. And you kind of get thrown out at times because your project costs more than another one, or you can't build as many units as a Portland. And so that kind of discussion needs to be had in the committee when they're making decisions, because you can't just keep going, you know, flat land building that's in the valley and leave rural Oregon out.
I'm listening to you talk, and I'm thinking, you know, one of the first things I would say as a member of the caucus, I'd say, I want everybody to raise their hand that doesn't come to the coast at one point or another during their time, because everybody takes advantage of the Oregon coast, but none of them there seem like they want to, you know, come off with the money to help things happen.
We use that argument. I use that, and the caucus uses that argument, because a lot of state money is shared or split, you know, gas tax, liquor tax, tobacco tax, and it's on per capita.
Based on population.
Based on population. And I like to remind the others that it's your population coming to the coast that's wearing out my roads or wearing out our parks or police force or everything, or you're the ones that are – your constituents are the ones that are buying the cannabis in the coast. And don't make fun of us for having a lot of
– cannabis stores.
Cannabis
stores. Yeah, we have to keep up with the demand, right?
Bingo. Exactly. You know, your constituents just aren't buying in their neighborhood. They're coming to the coast to do it. And those things have – I don't know if it's helped, but I could tell they're listening. And – If I can, a good example was a piece of legislation that I carried on the Senate floor was having to do with building in tsunami zones. I forget the bill number, but it actually passed. And prior to this session, you couldn't build in tsunami zones and stuff. Rather than saying no, what the bill said, you know, let's say yes, but build to a standard. Let's establish a standard that will withhold or make sense. And, you know, let us build. My argument on the floor was you in Portland are certainly in the Cascadia zone. When the big earthquake comes, you're going to fall apart, as we most likely all will, but you're continuing to build. You're building because of Cascadia. Why shouldn't the coast be able to build to a tsunami? Who knows when it's going to happen? But let's both build to a standard that has a better chance. And actually, I could see the argument made sense, because prior to that, they'd said no building, you know, in tsunami zones. So I think it's, you know, it's having an impact. It's a long hoe because the numbers aren't there, but you're right.
What are some of the things that you were happy that happened in the last legislative session? Was there anything in there that stuck out with you that was able to move forward?
I can talk about my disappointments, but
I knew that, and that's why I kind of went with the others, trying to find some positives.
Yeah, the positives was money, and I'm I'm disappointed, and maybe I shouldn't be, that the major thing I could accomplish was bring money back to the region, to the Senate district. And there was really a great deal. When you look at the map of the state and where projects were funded and stuff, all types, the coast did very well in it. And I think I owe a lot to the caucus. And I think also, as much as people would not like to hear this, that I was a part of a small group of Republicans that chose not to walk out when one gun bill came to the floor. And in essence, it was a reward for that. And I don't want it to go, oh, you were bought off, because that wasn't the case.
No, you stood. I'm assuming you stood by your standards, and this had nothing to do with the other.
Exactly. Yeah. But the other party, the majority party, saw that in fact you'd stay and discuss. We were able, as a group, we were able to soften some bad legislation and do away with some proposed legislation. So it paid. But Georgia, I would say the money that we brought forth Lakeside, South Lakeside, $14 million for their sewer water plan. And again, unfortunately, their Shutter Creek is being closed by the governor. They were a big supplier of revenue to the city. And so what the downfall of that is, as that goes away, the citizens are going to have to pay up with their
costs. Now there's more housing. Well, no, I'm kidding, obviously.
So, we're able to put money there. Helped the Port of Coos Bay buy some land for development right on the waterfront, the old Georgia Pacific GP site. That'll be jobs. And North funded a housing project, actually affordable housing project, down to 30 and 60% median income. So it took subsidy, was able to tap into the state for subsidy. So I forget right now the total millions, but it was as a region, we did very well in finally bringing some dollars back to the region.
So the subsidy on affordable housing, obviously it costs the same amount to build a house. You're not going to build a house more cheaply. So are you subsidizing the builder's cost, the homeowner's purchase? How does that work?
You raised the right question. When someone, a developer or anybody, talks about affordable or workforce, anything other than market rate, there's got to be a subsidy in there. And I would hope and educate the consumer and everybody else to start asking those who are proposing those kind of projects just that question. Where is the subsidy? Don't just tell me it's going to be affordable, because really the only way you do it is you build cheaper, you take less in profit, or there's subsidy, and equity into the project from somewhere else. Those are the only ways you can get to below market.
And obviously building cheaper is not a viable option.
On the coast, that one doesn't work real well. And the other for-profit developers, there's no way, someone's going to do their daily work and not get paid for it. So that's not going to happen. So it ends up being finding the subsidy. And typically what happens is publicly owned land comes into play and is donated.
We did that here in Florence. There was a property over there off of Airport Road that they did that with.
There's nothing wrong with that because, and I like to remind the listeners that, again, typically government agencies, governments like cities, they're motivated to get the supply up, as we're talking. That the problem is not enough housing in a range that you need, targeting renters and homeowners. So it's not a profit. In essence, the government is not, in this case, the city is not looking to make a profit. They're looking to get the housing. Versus the developer, a for-profit developer, is looking to make a profit by developing housing. So it's a different process. So, you can go in there, you can do deed restrictions, you can donate land, you can do things as and put deed restrictions on it that has to be affordable for number of years. And that's typically what happens, to depending on how much subsidy is there and what your target audience is.
Yeah, because they're building $400,000 to $750,000 homes in Florence right now.
Right.
That's not the problem.
Correct.
And the problem is having the people, because we don't have enough staff in the restaurants or in the retail stores now, because once COVID happened, many of them moved on or are still on unemployment, can't find housing. It's really tough.
Well, and we know also that the minimum wage in this state is three different price.
Right, three different levels.
And,
yeah.
And so when your housing cost, which is your major cost, costs the same or even more than a metropolitan area, and the metropolitan area has a higher minimum wage, which the service industry kind of ties into, why wouldn't you move? And that's what's happened. You know, what is it, $15, close to $15, $14.75 now in the Portland area, or metropolitan areas, and we're at $2.75.
Which is really odd, because when you look at the business, when I go down Bay Street and I look at the restaurants that are in business, they are packed to the gills. They are definitely able to make money at this juncture, but they may not have enough staff to do it. Higher minimum wage, a more uniform minimum wage might be a more positive answer.
Well, but two, what I've seen in those, and you're right, they're busy, but they're controlling the capacity. Whether it's hotels, a lot of the hotels aren't renting out all the rooms as they could, even though they have the demand, because they can't get them cleaned fast enough.
Well, now that is true there. But with restaurants, though, it's when the governor dropped the restrictions on June 30th, I mean, they kind of went, I don't want to use the term, but to the wall, you know,
trying to make
back up.
Yeah.
So.
But I was in a restaurant, this run that I'm up and down today, yesterday, where they aren't going to do a dinner service because they couldn't staff. They did breakfast and lunch, but not going to do a dinner service because they wearing out their existing staff.
Yeah. So what about the next session? What are you looking forward to in the next session?
Next session, there's two coming up. So one is a special session in September, September 20th. And it's designated simply for the redistricting, where we every 10 years redistrict the Senate and House districts.
Move the lines
and congressional,
around. Yeah.
Move the lines to balance out. So that will go on. Special sessions are limited to what they could talk about, and that's supposedly going to be the only thing that we're going to talk about. So then into 2022 is the short session, limited to 35 days, February, March. And that you're limited by the number of bills we can submit and that kind of stuff. And it's, in theory, should be limited to budgets. And then emergency kind of issues that need to take place where some current legislation isn't working well. But that, unfortunately, in the past years, has also been where huge policy issues come into play and they run it through. So I hope that doesn't happen. My concern continues to be, from this session we just completed, is the ongoing operational costs of our agencies and support systems that we provide as a state. They're not sustainable at the level they're funded. This session, were turned around in the middle of the session from being concerned about a billion to $2 billion shortfall when we entered the session in January to $1 to $2 billion surplus at the end because of the federal money that came in. Granted, it was for capital improvements, that kind of stuff, but that freed up state money, that general funds, that would have gone to capital.
Right.
And then instead, which is fine, except the state legislators ended up creating hundreds of new jobs, new policies that cost money, include employees, include, I think, two new agencies, a lot of expansion of existing agencies, which all means more operating costs for next biennium.
Yeah. The money you had in surplus is being sucked away.
And we didn't put very little of that money goes into the reserves or backfills where we pulled out for COVID and stuff. So it remains a concern for me is absent taxing more, and that's always the answer, taxing more, you know, how we're going to maintain at that level. And we've got to bite the bullet at some point, I think, and say these aren't priorities any longer. you know, they were at, when we did them, we don't need them today, or they're not as effective as today, and start prioritizing where we as a state see the real need. Now, I think we made some good progress. We put a lot of money in housing, $500 million roughly. We also put a lot of money in behavioral health, mental health, never before. Those are two crucial areas that I think, as you've stated, and I agree, they're at the base of a lot of our problems. And if we don't get going on that, you know, we're never going to fix this.
And I can remember when the federal government kind of defunded mental health altogether. And that was, you can see, if you look back now, you can see the downhill slide that occurred because of that. So putting money back into that is definitely a good thing.
Yeah. Now, it'll take a while to have the results, but it's a start. And boy, the way it's allocated, there have been big bunches of specific things, and there'll be a lot of what I call rulemaking to get the money out to the street. And that's really a way back to the coast. What I noticed in that kind of stuff, they always talked about pilot programs or things, which I love, but they never had one on the coast. And so I made numerous amendments to bills that said, but let's put one on the coast. Now, I don't care where, but we've got to get something on the west side of the coastal range. And they were very receptive to that. So I think it's because Bend would always be designated, and then up and down the I-5. But and it's happened again, even with redistricting, with these hearings and stuff, that there's nothing that's designated on the coast. So I've asked for, even if it's a virtual one, let's designate it as coastal specific, so that people want to testify, know that it's just them and not get mixed in with all other conversations.
That's about all the time we have. I appreciate you coming in.
Thank you.
Great to get to know you a little bit better and hear what you got to say. It's good stuff.
I'll keep doing it as long as you'll allow me.
Well, the door's always open.
Okay.
Dick Anderson, right. State Senator, we appreciate you being here.
Thank you, George.
In our final segment this afternoon, we talk with Andy Grizz-Kowiak, Superintendent of Siuslaw Schools, coming up on the September edition of Our Town.